Richard Strauss is a hard man to pin down. As an artist, he was never tied to a single style.
He was a very facile composer. I mean, he could write with an ease that's incredible.
Some of his tone poems, just the sound of them, were quite shocking.
Sometimes we read of the soprano riding the orchestra, kind of surfing the wave of the orchestra.
Richard Strauss embraced many musical forms during his lifetime. There was only one guiding principle, his artistic compass, that music is a holy art. He set those very words to music in his opera, Ariadne of Naxos. For Strauss, this was far more than a line in a libretto. It was a way of life. In this three-part series, we'll explore many sides of Strauss, and in this first segment, we'll examine his tone poems. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt. Welcome to Music is a Holy Art, a Richard Strauss celebration from WQXR in New York.
Well, Richard Strauss for me remains the ultimate master of pictorial music, of music that is meant overtly to represent something beyond music, notes on a page.
That's Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops and the BBC Concert Orchestra.
Obviously, not necessarily the father of programmatic music, but certainly the person who took the idea of taking extra musical sources and narrating them in musical terms to a whole new level.
Strauss first came to prominence writing tone poems, pieces where the structure of the music is dictated by the stories they are based on. And in telling these musical stories, Strauss made great demands on his players, showing off the limits of what an orchestra can do.
What happens in a Straussian orchestra is that you have to be a virtuoso player, no matter what instrument you play. You have to have an army of generals.
That's Brian Gilliam, one of the world's great Strauss scholars and author of many books and articles on Strauss. He teaches at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina.
What fascinates me about Strauss is his focus on contrast. The harmony, he calls it the harmony of contrasts.
Strauss preferred to follow one composition with something either totally different or exactly the opposite. We'll see this in action as we examine some of his tone poems, which he started writing as a young man in his early 20s. In 1889, Strauss caused an international sensation with his tone poem Don Juan, a musical portrait of the most infamous lover of all time. So what's going on here?
We have a opening theme that shoots up, in two measures, a couple of octaves or more. I mean, it doesn't take a Sigmund Freud to figure out this vaulting melody and what it means in its erotic profile. So we have this vaulting, energetic melody, which gives us the immediate picture, this man with a huge libido and seemingly inexhaustible sexual desire.
Eventually, we witness Don Juan meeting his first lover. He is enchanted. She is a high-strung lady.
It's high-strung, literally. It's in the violins. It's a very chromatic melody, full of passion.
Strauss frequently used solo violin to portray a woman, but it is the overflowing orchestra sound that would become his signature style.
The Germans call it Wohlklang, and I don't know, it's not really a good translation for that. It's a burnished, highly polished, lush sound. You just are sitting in a bath of sonic splendor.
There are many versions of the Don Juan story. Strauss used the one by Nikolaus Lenau as the basis for his tone poem, and he included the following quote in his published score.
My friend, would that I could fly through every place where beauty blossoms, fall on my knees before each one, and were it but for a moment, conquer.
And conquer he does.
He's irresistible, and they fall for him every time, and that's the way the story works. In this Don Juan, he's Always ready for more.
And so we move on to lover number two. This time, the woman is portrayed by the oboe.
It's a very sweet, lovely tune, suggesting not so much a high-strung woman, but a more poetic, serene, reflective woman.
The French horn was Strauss's favorite instrument, and he uses the horns to represent Don Juan himself. Here's Alan Gilbert, conductor of the New York Philharmonic.
I've always thought of that as a very masculine theme. Somehow it's a, hey, look at this moment, and this kind of strutting sense. It's so proud and so, in a way, vain.
After vividly portraying Don Juan in music, Strauss turned to something far more serious, death and transfiguration. Back to Brian Gilliam.
It is the most serious of all his tone poems. Even the ones that have a serious topic usually have some kind of humor in them at some point. Don Juan is erotics and humor. And one wonders, again, he was around 25, 26, a young man who had no major illnesses, is contemplating what it feels like to die.
This time Strauss makes up the story himself. Here are Strauss's words.
It was 6 years ago that it occurred to me to present in the form of a tone poem the dying hours of a man who had striven toward the highest idealistic aims, maybe indeed those of an artist.
In the time of the tone poems, they're all artist heroes, these protagonists. So this artist hero is dying. We have this wonderfully cinematic opening scene.
The sick man lies in bed asleep with heavy, irregular breathing. Friendly dreams conjure a smile on the features of the deeply suffering man. He wakes up. He is once more racked with horrible agonies. His limbs shake with fever. As the attack passes and the pains leave off, his thoughts wander through his past life. His childhood passes before him, the time of his youth, with its strivings and passions.
You got to remember, of course, that Strauss is a lifelong atheist. So his whole view is that we don't go to heaven, there is no God, but we are transformed. Our end is our art. We end in our ideal.
As our artist hero gets closer to death, he glimpses his own ideal. And Strauss gives the ideal a musical theme. Here's what the ideal sounds like.
As the pains already begin to return, there appears to him the fruit of his life's path, the conception, the ideal which he has sought to realize, to present artistically, but which he has not been able to complete, since it is not for man to be able to accomplish such things.
Our artist hero is running out of time.
The hour of death approaches.
And with the striking of the gong, he's dead.
The soul leaves the body in order to find gloriously achieved in everlasting space those things which could not be fulfilled here below.
At this point, the piece has shifted to something new.
It begins in C minor, it ends in C major. It is transfigured, transformed. from the minor to the major. And that is a musical convention that has a very powerful narrative implication. And this ideal theme comes back in fragments, it kind of a build-up, and then we have this final presentation. For the first time, the full orchestral presentation of the ideal in C major. The idea of transformation, transfiguration, was a lifelong thing for Strauss.
Much more about that later. After Death and Transfiguration, Strauss tried his hand at writing opera, his first. It was called Guntram, named after its title character. Strauss wrote the libretto himself, creating the name Guntram by combining two characters from Wagner operas, Gunther in Götterdämmerung and Wolfram in Tannhäuser. More importantly, he wrote the lead female role Freihild for his future wife Pauline, who sang the premiere. He proposed to her during the rehearsals. Unfortunately, the opera was not a success, and Strauss took it very badly. He went back to writing tone poems, and this time, something far more lighthearted.
Once upon a time, there was a knavish fool named Till Eulenspiegel.
Originally, Strauss was planning to make an opera out of Till Eulenspiegel, the infamous German folklore prankster, but ultimately decided a tone poem worked better with the subject matter.
What he wanted to do, basically, was to have a tone poem about a character who makes fun of and tricks a very narrow-minded community.
And so Strauss wrote his most humorous tone poem, the complete title of which is Till Eulenspiegel's Gleeful Exploits After an Old Rogue's Tale Set in Rondo Form for Large Orchestra, Opus 28.
It's not really a complete story. They're just little sonic pictures.
There are many versions of the folk tales, but Strauss makes up his own. In his version of the story, Till plays a series of pranks on the citizens of a town called Schilda, and sonically they are quite graphic. Here's Michael Tilson Thomas, conductor of the San Francisco Symphony and the New World Symphony in Miami.
Some of the very wry episodes that occur along the way, the barking of dogs as Till tries to storm his way into a gated enclosure. Moment when he, on the roof, decides to relieve himself onto his tormentors below, which is very perfectly represented by the violin solo, the glissando. That's what that's supposed to represent.
But Till Eulenspiegel is a very interesting case because he was absolutely angry at Munich.
Strauss was born and raised in Munich. His family and childhood friends were there.
But on the other hand, he saw Munich as a city of conservative Philistines.
And Strauss, behaving just like Till Eulenspiegel, plays a trick on Munich. And the trick has to do with the name Till Eulenspiegel.
Literally, it means, Eulen means owl, and Spiegel means mirror.
An owl who holds up a mirror to society to show them their own stupidity.
But if you go back to medieval German, Eulen often means to wipe. And Spiegel is a reference to one's ass, one's hindsight. So it kind of, in our language, means kiss my ass. Which is what Till Eulenspiegel is saying to these citizens of Schilda. And that's what he wanted to tell Munich after they rejected his Guntram. Basically, he's saying, kiss my ass.
A spectacular musical screw you.
He said that even in his letters. This is my great joke on everybody. He was in a bad mood, and this is humor, but it's a mean humor.
The mean humor comes from the philosopher Nietzsche, whom Strauss was reading at the time.
Nietzsche talks about laughing a lot, but when Nietzsche talks about laughing, it's from above, laughing on high. You poor people, I make jokes about you. And it's that spiteful humor that Strauss employs at this time. And, of course, Also sprach Zarathustra is the best example of that.
Also sprach Zarathustra, which translates as Thus Spoke Zarathustra, is the most recognizable piece Strauss wrote. Here's New York Philharmonic conductor Alan Gilbert.
It's an amazing work that, of course, has this iconic beginning that is unforgettable and probably unmatched in any music before or since in terms of orchestral sonic glory.
You probably know this music from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, but here it is set to Nietzsche's words.
When Zarathustra was 30 years old, he left his home and the lake of his home and went into the mountains. There he enjoyed his spirit and solitude, and for 10 years did not weary of it. But at last his heart changed. And rising one morning with the rosy dawn, he went before the sun and spoke to it thus. You, great star, what would your happiness be had you not those for whom you shine?
To Brian Gilliam.
So what he's doing is taking his Nietzschean ideas, again, a lifelong atheist, seeing it through the lens of Also sprach Zarathustra, mainly because there's so many references to song and dance. This is the frame he can use.
Nietzsche's book is written in a biblical style, but it's actually mocking the Bible. It's a collection of 80 fictional speeches by the ancient religious figure Zarathustra, and Strauss chose 8 of them to set to music.
Strauss said the fundamental point of Also sprach Zarathustra was the tension, the lifelong tension between humanity and nature. And nature is in C major, humanity just a half step away in B. So most of these selections involve this tension between finite man and infinite nature.
Finite man, according to Nietzsche, has a will to power. Other philosophers tell us to deny the will. It leads us to do wicked things.
Nietzsche says, no, let's grab the bull by the horns and ride that bull wherever it takes us. Just hold on. Hold on to life and live life to the fullest.
Nietzsche tells us to celebrate the will. And how does one celebrate the will? You dance.
Beyond all heavens did I want to dance. Only in the dance do I know how to speak the parable of the highest things.
And this is what Nietzsche loves, the idea of dance, celebration of the body. And this is all what Strauss loves, celebrate the body, dance.
Hearken, my brethren, to the voice of the healthy body. It is a more upright and pure voice, and it speaketh of the meaning of the earth.
What did Strauss write next? Something completely different. He wrote Don Quixote, fantastic variations on a theme of knightly character, based on the great novel by Cervantes. Why use theme and variations? Here's conductor Alan Gilbert.
It actually is a very clever way to tell this story, to have themes that live through the work, as characters live through their lives and interact in different ways, but transform them according to what is actually happening and how time goes on and how things happen. Makes a lot of sense.
There are two protagonists in this story, and Strauss represents each with an instrument, his own musical orchestral casting. Don Quixote himself is performed, for the most part, by a solo cello. And his partner, Sancho Panza, is represented by the viola. Don Quixote and Sancho go on many adventures. Well, misadventures would be a better way to put it. And Strauss chose very specific misadventures to represent sonically.
Obviously, you're not going to be able to translate the whole book into a tone poem, but nonetheless, what, again, he's interested in is the stories that are the most evocative, such as when Don Quixote is going to take on this army.
This is the day, Sancho, on which I shall show the might of my arm, and on which I intend to do deeds that shall be written in the books of fame for succeeding ages.
Which turns out is really not an army, but a herd of sheep.
Don Quixote does all of this for the love of a beautiful woman, Dulcinea.
We have this idealized Dulcinea theme in his mind, and then we have the actual meeting of Dulcinea with this very squawky oboe. You can really see the real Dulcinea in music, and I can imagine this kind of garlic breath peasant with fat sausage fingers.
Dulcinea's beauty is enhanced by a mole above her right lip, like a mustache, with 7 or 8 long red hairs emanating from it.
For nature bestowed on Dulcinea nothing that was not perfect and well finished. Wherefore, if she had 100 moles similar to the one you have described, they would not be moles, but moons and glittering stars.
With each variation, we get a new sonic adventure, each one more daring than the last.
When they take this imaginary trip through the air, he uses wind machine, and it's an incredible sound.
Don Quixote and Sancho are blindfolded, put on a wooden horse, and told the horse will fly them to their destination. In reality, several large bellows are blowing wind at them while they stay in place. After a short time, Sancho notices a discrepancy.
Señor, how do they make out we are going up so high? If their voices reach us here, and they seem to be speaking quite close to us.
After the follies of Don Quixote, Strauss turned to something more grandiose, Ein Heldenleben, or A Hero's Life. This is a massive work with a spectacular heroic sound to it. Here's conductor Michael Tilson Thomas.
There's an amazing outpouring of music in the introduction to the piece, the statement of the hero's themes. And it's just meant to be so thrilling and huge and overwhelming, generous.
And who is the hero in this story? Strauss himself. However, it's worth noting that Don Quixote and A Hero's Life are a pair of tone poems. They were written simultaneously, and Strauss expected them to be performed together. He saw himself as both Don Quixote and a hero.
It's an irresistible romp. The message of it is be yourself, don't let your enemies get you down, and it deals with the experience that all performers have, all composers have, all people who put their personalities out before the public, that some people get it, some people don't get it.
Right after we meet our hero, we meet his enemies, the critics.
The critics come in And what they have done, basically, is to just seize on a couple of small little portions of the music we've just heard. Instead of understanding the big vision of it, they've become obsessed with some little point which they're just chewing in the way a dog chews an old bone.
There were many critics who didn't like Strauss, and on the surface, this would seem to be that mean humor again, making fun of his enemies. Brian Gilliam says it's more than that.
If you look at the sketches where he's sketching that part, he talks about the hero confronts both his inner and outer critics. He starts with the inner. So this is the complete person has to dissect himself, must know himself, must confront his inner demons.
Our hero will also fall in love. We now come to another theme that will come back later on in Strauss's work, and that is the importance of the domestic. The hero's companion is portrayed by the solo violin. Here are Strauss's words.
It is my wife I wanted to show. She is very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, a little coquettish, never like herself, at every minute different from how she had been a moment before.
Our hero does battle with his enemies. And he is victorious. Our hero returns home triumphant to find contentment in family life. More than any other instrument, Strauss identified himself with the French horn, and he certainly does that here. The horn parts are spectacular. Many consider this grand tone poem to be the summation of all Strauss's earlier tone poems. And this could be because melodies from previous tone poems come flooding back. Remember Don Juan? Strauss brings back many tunes from his earlier tone poems and creates a jigsaw puzzle of familiar melodies, overlaying them on top of each other. For instance, here is the Dulcinea theme from Don Quixote played at the same time as the love theme from his opera Guntram. So how did Strauss choose which melodies to bring back?
The tunes that come back from the previous tone poems in this grand final section of Held in Labor were all themes associated with love. So this is what I mean by this return to domestic bliss, this return home.
Ein Heldenleben ends with an extended duet between the French horn and the violin, representing Strauss and his wife at home together. Next time, we'll see what happened when Strauss again turned his musical imagination to the world of opera. You're listening to a three-part series from WQXR in New York. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt, and we are celebrating the great composer, Richard Strauss, a man who believed that music is a holy art.